Yeah, thanks everybody for calling. Just a few business official stuff out of the way. Meetings are organised by the ABC, the Amateur Black Cross. ABC works internationally for the abolition of the prison system in general. We oppose prisons. We oppose the judicial system as we've got to learn it. We oppose it from a revolutionary perspective, libertarian perspective, socialist perspective, anarchist perspective, call it what you want. We believe that prisons are an integral part of the class system that we live in, and they're vital to the survival of the class system. So we sort of, it's important that we're, the speakers tonight aren't claiming to be from that perspective, but the people who are organising the meeting are, you know. And they will be from that perspective, I don't know. But, you know, we're not for reform of the prison system or for the abolition. We get from groups like such as Amnesty in that way. We welcome reform of prison systems, but we don't, it's not what we're about. It's not the end in itself. In Belfast we've been set up probably for a year or so. We're a small group here, a very small group. We exist around two, we see the prison system existing on two levels. We believe that the prisons can get away with human rights abuses in two ways. Firstly, by keeping the society ignorant of the all forms of abuse that occur in jail, and that goes from, in our opinions, just human degradation, sexual abuse, forms of slavery, and that goes right up until murder, direct murder or murder by proxy. So eventually it is our aim to be able to someday expose, prison does two things. The prison system dehumanises the individual and keeps society ignorant, and through them two processes they're able to push through human rights abuses. It's our aim to combat both of these processes. The two people here have done a great job of exposing human rights abuses in McGarry and Highbank. Phil Stratton here is Professor of Criminology at Queen's University. Linda is an investigator working with the Human Rights Commission, Northern Ireland Human Rights Commission. Between them they were commissioned in 2004 to produce these booklets here, The Hurt and Save, and another report that came out of the findings in this here, The Prison Within. It's fair to say that the reports rocked the prison system here, and it did for a short while, at least I can say for certain, let the prison service know that they were being watched, and it brought in some that was noticed in the prison, and it was felt amongst the prison population. So just before we take off, you know, the one element of prison policy that is keeping the people ignorant about what goes on is going to be dealt with here by the two speakers tonight. The other element of prison tactic, the dehumanising of the prisoner, I would just like to spend a short time just putting names to the victims, to the very, very real victims, to the cases that we're speaking about, because these are human beings, regardless of what the media is shoving down our throats. I'm aware that we will have families of some of the people here, and it's not easy to do research, but something that jails will also do is try to release as little as possible information on their victims. Prisons release statistics, release numbers, they very rarely release names. These are victims of the prison system, which is outside of what we would call, you know, the national question. It's not the Republican or loyalist thing. These are working class victims. The victims since in the past decades that have fallen victim to the prison system. James McDonald. Sorry, and I apologise if any of these details are wrong. James McDonald, 35-year-old from Belfast. He died following an altercation with staff at McGarry Punishment Block, 30th of March 1996. Stephen Hamill died by hanging in McGarry, 28th of July 1986. Janet Holmes, 20 years old from Derry, died by hanging on the Punishment Blocks in Moore House, McGarry, 23rd of November 1996. Thomas Sharp, 19 years old from Belfast, Deborah Hangen in Haybank, 2nd of March 2000. Mark Fulton, 42 years old, from Portadown. Deborah Hangen in the punishment block of McGabbery, 10th of June 2002. Anne Kelly, 20 years old, from Strabán. Deborah Hangen in punishment block Warren House, McGabbery, 7th of September 2002. Eamon McKinney, 33 years old, from Warren Point. Deborah Hangen, Lagan House, McGabbery, 5th of April 2003. Patrick Mongan, from Derry. Deborah Hangen, McGilligan Prison, 19th of October 2003. Duncan Brown, 23 years old, from Leicester in England. Deborah Hangen in the punishment block of McGabbery, 12th of November 2003. Roseanne Irvine, 34 year old, mother of one, from Belfast. Deborah Hangen in the punishment block at Moran House, McGabbery, 3rd of March 2004. John McGrath, 49 year old, from County Fermanagh. Deborah Hangen, Bush House, McGabbery, 12th of December 2004. Thomas McKenzie Quinn, 45 year old, from Belfast. Died following contact with Legionnaires virus in water in McGilligan Prison, 15th of December 2006. John Kennedy, 44 year old, father of five, from Belfast. Died hanging in punishment block at McGabbery, 8th of June 2007. And I have to say, a lot of these people died in circumstances that the families are keen to stress that they dispute the jail's burdens on facts. And I'd just like to also mention somebody who contributed as a prisoner to this report, Mary Burns, a friend of mine, and she was released from Moran House in McGabbery in 2004. Mary died alone in England last Christmas, unfortunately, from suicide as well. And my recollection, she was the last Republican hunger striker, and she was a great girl. So those are the people, the victims humanised, hopefully. Now let Phil take over.
Thanks very much. I think it's really important when we have sessions like this that we do remember people by name. I think it's the only way that we can really in some ways identify with the real issue. And before I start talking about how we're going to deal with the session, I want to tell you a story about Mary. We've met Mary in Moran House in McGabbery, and she was already at that point in a very distressed state. She had very little weight, she wasn't eating very well, and she was objecting to the fact that her and another Republican prisoner who was with her were not having the same equal treatment as the men in terms of separation, and she was demanding the right to separation. And at that point we're there as researchers actually in the prison working with the women, and it's one of those moments where it's a totally different issue. You're dealing with the actual politics, the direct politics of the situation, and you're no longer at that moment a researcher. And we tried to negotiate, because we could see the way that this whole process was going. We tried to negotiate with the governor of Moran House. And then I'll never forget it. It was on Maundy Thursday, and we got a phone call. Linda took the call, saying that Mary was now on hunger strike, and she was several days into it, and would we come in. And we went into the prison on Good Friday morning, and we had access to go straight direct to the cells, and we were met by the women's governor, who was a man, and the governor in charge of security for McGabbery, and they sat on the other side of the table. And we said, you know, basically what's happening, and they said, we're going to give them separation on Easter Monday morning in 4 days time. And I said, well, why have we come? It just seems ridiculous that we've come all this way. Why have we come? And they said, because we don't negotiate with prisoners, and we don't negotiate with hunger strikers. And I said, let me get this right. You're giving them separation, which is why she's on hunger strike. She's ill already. She's now been on a hunger strike for over a week. She's not eaten anything for over a week. She's not in a good state at all. You're giving the separation, and we are here at this minute. For what reason? And it was obvious. They wanted us to tell us so that the governors, the management of the prison, would not in that situation be giving in to a hunger striker. And they could then look their own prison officers, the screws, in the eye and say, we didn't negotiate that, the Human Rights Commission did, or the people who were working on behalf of the Human Rights Commission did. So I said, you know, this is ridiculous, not prepared to do it. And he looked at me and obviously misjudged me because he assumed a Liverpool accent meant that I wouldn't have very much knowledge of local politics. And he said, you're in Northern Ireland now. And I said, yeah, I know precisely where I am. He said, and in Northern Ireland we don't negotiate with hunger strikers. And I said, I thought that that, oh yeah, he said, you know, 10 men died here. Like I didn't know. And I said, well actually, if we were being factually accurate, we'd say it was 11, and possibly many more who died prematurely as a consequence of the hunger strike. And I said, and I thought that the Thatcher principle died with them. I'm not going to continue that story because inevitably they gave in and they told Mary that she had separation. We told them to trust them for this once, that we would be back in on the Monday if it didn't happen, and they were given separation. But why I wanted to mention that was first of all, it's in the first report, why I wanted to mention it was first of all to pay tribute to Mary's memory. Because I think Linda and I talked about this, and I think we would agree that certainly if prison didn't kill her, it contributed to her premature death. We'll never be sure of that, we'll never demonstrate that or prove it, but I think over the years, 25 years, I've been working on prisons, and I'm a founder member of Inquest in 1980, I've worked on deaths in custody all that time. And I think I can say it with some authority that the prison certainly contributed, prison health contributed to her death. I also want to tell the story because it shows exactly the intransigence of a prison service at a particular moment who is actually prepared, after all we've been through here, after all these years, is actually prepared to negotiate over a person's life. I'm going to talk briefly for me. Last year I did a talk at Failure that was in St. Mary's on the first report. I'm going to talk more generally about the work that I've done on deaths in custody and the context, the issues, the contextual issues that I see as being really important. And then Linda is going to talk more substantially about the work that we've done together over the last 4 years. The issue, I want to start by saying that the issue isn't confined just to people who die in custody or in detention, but as I've just mentioned in terms of Mary's case, it extends to those who die while they're under arrest or being arrested, while they're being detained in their homes, prior to custody, those who die post-custody, where the death is directly related to their experience of being in prison or detention. That can be very soon after. It can be people taking their own lives soon after they return to the community with very little support from state services. Or it can be a longer term death. We can never know when people die prematurely of illness how much the trauma of prison has impacted on their lives. And obviously we know that to some extent in terms of political prisoners here, but in terms of ordinary prisoners, or what people would call social prisoners, we can never be sure how much prison has contributed to early death. I also want to just raise the issue that there are different and distinct circumstances between and within the broader categories of deaths. And I think we should just think about that for a second, the issues around gender and imprisonment, sexuality and imprisonment, the continual pressures on women who have histories of abuse, the damage that those women have suffered prior to coming into prison, and the way in which the prison approaches them simply as women prisoners without actually thinking about the context of their lives and the abusiveness that many women have suffered. Issues around sexuality, goodness knows what it will be like when the first transgendered person goes to prison here in the north, and it nearly happened while we were doing the research. But sexuality is really significant, not only because of issues like transgender, but issues in terms of lesbian prisoners, homosexual male prisoners, people who are struggling with their sexuality and who in prison experience the full pressure of the environment. As we know, as Kieran will testify, male prisons in terms of gender and sexuality operate on a culture of masculinity, and male prison officers and some female prison officers operate on that culture of masculinity too, a culture of masculinity that's deeply ingrained, that has a long legacy within our prisons, and also the range of bullying that goes on within that context. One of the things that we're working on at the moment is a book called The Violence of Incarceration, and I am an abolitionist, The Violence of Incarceration, where I would argue, and many of my colleagues internationally would argue, that prison itself, by its very nature, by its very form, is a violent institution. It can't else be otherwise. So it's not just about direct interpersonal bullying, it's about the way a system operates and the way a system works. Age is another absolutely crucial issue. Age is a crucial issue because we send children to prison in a way in which most other states outside of the US and outside of Russia, interestingly, they would be the two most extreme examples, we send children as young as 10 to prison. And we send children now to prison who've never committed a crime, whose only crime is the breach of their antisocial behaviour order. In England, at the moment, England and Wales, we send the equivalent of one entire young offenders institution to prison at any one time, simply for breaching their antisocial behaviour orders. We send people, young people, to prison in breach and contravention of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, which says that it always must be a last resort. And we put them into these places of incarceration without any real consideration or understanding of the damage that's being done to them. I think one of the other issues around sending children to prison is we send children to prison to special units, to special secure units. We don't even call them prisons. We send children to prison here in terms of the juvenile justice unit. It sounds so liberal when you call a prison something that it isn't. The bottom line is that a prison is a prison is a prison, and if only Thatcher had thought in those terms instead of the ones that she did. I'm going to deal briefly with mental ill health in a second, but mental ill health is a major issue in terms of imprisonment, both in terms of people being admitted to prison who are in great struggles with their own health, but also what happens to people when they're in prison. We also send people to prison, we create a hierarchy of violence. One of the books that first ever got me into working in this area of work was Jimmy Boyle's A Sense of Freedom. And strangely enough, in one of the pieces I've been writing in the last few weeks, I've been using his experiences as a starting point, because in the late 1980s, one of the first major pieces of research I was involved with was a protest in Scottish prisons, where Jimmy had been himself incarcerated. The level of violence that we came across that were meted out in those prisons to prisoners simply on the basis that they were seen as the hard men and also the hard women, and they were to be taken down. And Peter Head, a specific prison in Scotland, operated with that brief. And the powers that the screws, the powers that the prison officers had, were far greater than in any of the other prisons. Prisoners also perceived as a management problem. One of the things that I think most people were shocked about in our research, and Linda will be talking about this, was the use of punishment cells for women who were self-harming. So we get to the end of any kind of road in terms of care when the only way that we deal with women who self-harm, or men who self-harm, or boys or girls who self-harm, is to put them in a strip cell, in a punishment block, where they're locked in isolation for 23 hours out of 24. The best they can hope for, even on association, is a lockdown of 16 hours out of 24. We have this image that prisons are full of people moving around. For the vast majority of a person's sentence, they're locked down. And as I say, the best they can hope for is 8 hours or 7 hours out of their cells. So self-harm and the management of self-harm is a crucial issue, particularly when that's related to the risk that we're putting people at. And then one of the other issues that's become so prevalent in the work that I've done over the years is where I can see that deaths have been encouraged. Where staff, because they have such a management problem, in inverted commas, on their hands, they actually say, well, go on then, do it, top yourself, take your own life, we'll walk away. The first time I came across that was in Glenogle Young Offenders Detention Complex in Scotland in 1984, where 8 young men died in just over a year's period, and 25 came very close to death. The culture of encouragement in that situation was something that I could hardly comprehend, and something that stayed with me ever since. And encouraged death through taunts, through threats, those are part of that issue. What I also would want to, in terms of setting the scene, what I also want to say is that violence in prison is a continuum. Liz Kelly and Elizabeth Stanko, in their work on violence against women, they talk about the continuum of intimate partner violence, or as we would call it, domestic violence. What they say is that the taunts, the drip, drip, drip of undermining, of constantly giving a woman grief in terms of verbal abuse, in terms of pushing, is on the same continuum as beating and rape. They don't try to distinguish that there are some sorts of violence against a woman in a domestic relationship that are acceptable. We would argue exactly the same about prison. And that idea of violence of the prison as a continuum brings us to a point where we can see that the possibility that taking one's life is on the same continuum as brutality. That people do not take their own lives in a vacuum. They take their lives actually in a context. So it's on that continuum of, on the one hand, taking one's life to brutality, that we would focus our work. Understanding also the relationship in a prison between interpersonal violence, violence between prisoners, perhaps, violence between staff and prisoners, and institutionalized violation. In other words, we would argue that the long-term toleration of levels of violence on an interpersonal level are part of the institutionalization of that violence. It's the way the prison is. It's the way people are inducted into the prison when they arrive. I think one of the other issues that I would just want to actually state, rather than go into, because we haven't got time, is that there are very few people in prison who are not from working class backgrounds. The fact that we look at the whole process of imprisonment outside of the context of class and the location of people in class, their class, of particular areas of cities, particular communities. That is no coincidence. I was listening to Paula Johnson, who's an American professor, recently talking about the imprisonment of a community and the imprisonment of a prison. In other words, the argument that the gated communities that we now create, that are designed to keep people in communities as opposed to keep people out, are a direct class replica of the prison itself. I think the other issue, that the final sort of general contextual issue, is that there is a dichotomy, there is a contradiction between the concept of care and the duty of care that the state has when somebody is sent to prison, and the process of custody and what custody is. When people talk to me about the notion of a healthy prison, it's an oxymoron. You cannot have a healthy prison. You cannot administer a duty of care if your primary issue is custodial and discipline and order within a prison. In the 1980s, and following extensive primary research into deaths in police and prison custody and in detention and in the course of arrest and in young offenders institutions, Catherine Chadwick and I, who both of us have worked with over the years, demonstrated how the negative imagery, the way in which people's reputations are constructed, and the established ideologies that we have in our society are, quote, deeply institutionalised within the British state. I do not need to say that to an audience in the north of Ireland. The deep institutionalisation within the British state of ideologies of negative reputation are absolutely crucial. That was the card that Thatcher played all the way through the hunger strikes. It also, as we put it, provides the ready justification for the marginalisation of identifiable groups on the grounds of class, on the grounds of race and ethnicity, whatever that perception is. And that marginalisation has been successfully mobilised, and it deflects responsibility away from the institution, away from the prison itself. The political management then of that identity is what we call, and I'm quoting, a process of categorisation which suggests that those who are considered violent or dangerous or political extremists or subversive or alien or inadequate or mentally ill, they, when they die in custody, bring it on themselves. They contribute to their own deaths, either by their pathological condition or their personal choice. That deflects, what we were arguing there was that it completely deflects any responsibility away from the state. I want to just say something briefly about mental health. Those who come to prison or detention with mental health related problems, and it's a high proportion of people who go to prison, have some form of mental health problem, from depression across the spectrum to schizophrenia. Prison has become a warehouse for those who are given inadequate health care within the community or alternative forms of therapeutic intervention on the outside. We'll talk about the death of Roseanne Irvine and Annie Kelly in a short while. But both those women, the examples of what happened to them in prison, is in itself the issue. But also the broader issue is that they should never have been near a prison in the first place. Those, and then the second issue around mental health is that those who come to prison in good health, but whose physical or mental health deteriorates because of how they are incarcerated and the regimes of the prison that they endure. Now, it comes to something. If you remember, in terms of the Belmarsh and Whitemoor incidents in England, and the Irish prisoners held there, it comes to something when a British judge actually states that Irish prisoners in that context were not fit to plead in the court, were not fit to answer the charges against them, because the conditions in which they'd been held, and remember, it was a British judge saying this, the conditions in which they'd held had been so deleterious on their health that they were now no longer fit to come before a court. And that is the sharp end and the very public end of that issue, where people whose health deteriorates directly because of their incarceration. What I'm saying is, prisons house vulnerable people, but also they create and exacerbate that very vulnerability. What are the issues there? Lack of informed and appropriate professional support, inadequacy of psychology and psychiatry, and their emphasis always on the individual and individual pathology, at best on social pathology as a context. And what I would call the conspiracy that exists professionally to deny the context that is social, political, cultural and economic of prisoners' lives on the outside. The lack of community-based alternatives. It's no coincidence that we are having such serious problems in prisons in the north of Ireland, when we have one of the worst mental health services in Europe. And also, once in prison, the lack of independence of the prison mental health and broader healthcare services themselves. So, I want to return to a woman that I met, and I want to read you something before I finish my section. She was born in the 1920s on Merseyside, England, imprisoned under order, aged 11. She was classified as feeble-minded. Her offending behaviour was unspecified, persistent theft. Her incarceration lasted 45 years, behind the bars of harsh regimes. Judged aggressive and violent, she self-harmed. Jane Doe lives in recent history, an object of psychiatric and surgical experimentation. She's one of many women and men of great courage and determination whose private resistance to public degradation led eventually to their release. Her twilight years have been lived out in day-to-day routines of a society which for so long denied her existence. No explanations, no apologies, and no acknowledgement of the institutionalized brutalization of a locked-in ward. Yes, she was in an obscure mental health hospital. For much of the 20th century, Jane Doe and those similarly classified, including children born and brought up in mental hospitals, endured enforced mutilation, electrically induced convulsions, drugging and ritual humiliation. Their bodies and minds constituted unrestricted test sites in medicine's obsession with the identification and eradication of individual pathology. They feared the perpetrators, the formalized physical abuse of the doctors, accompanied by the routine informal assaults of care staff. And they feared the fate of absent friends, those who disappeared. A fear of death, not by natural causes, but by unlawful killing. Experiments that failed, drug cocktails with fatal side effects, restraint methods that suffocated, and suicides of despair. These were the consequences of licensed assault and the institutionalization of inhuman and degrading treatment. Another night trolley, another premature death. The night trolley that she talked about, and she used to hear it in the night and knew that one of her friends had died. She didn't know whether it was wet towel treatment or heart attack or taking her own life. Informed and endorsed by the pseudo-scientific principles of eugenicism, these punishing regimes were not confined to Nazi barbarism or other forms of totalitarian rule. They were central to routine treatment administered to those classified and researched as mentally disordered throughout social democracies, forming an invisible and virtually autonomous archipelago of incarceration in mental institutions, special hospitals and prisons. For such regimes to exist, to remain hidden from independent scrutiny, professionals within and beyond the network were involved. They were implicated through an unquestioning acceptance of classifications made by powerful definers and their failure to inquire into the dubious circumstances of unexplained deaths. Doctors, nurses, care workers, psychologists, psychiatrists, coroners, pathologists, police officers, lawyers, prison officers, administrators, clergy, they all remained silent, ambivalent, accepting. And we always must remember that somebody pushed the trolley. What I'm arguing here, and what we would share in terms of our work, is that the way in which medicine and law combine within our society, not only in terms of imprisoning, but also in terms of covering up in controversial cases, where we assume that each is the force for public good, medicine for care and cure, law for rights and justice, they don't operate in any way, even outside of the direct issue of political conflict. In ordinary, everyday life, they don't operate either in terms of caring or in terms of delivering rights. It's not only an issue about the context in which people die, it's also an issue in terms of the context in which those deaths are not reported, are not thoroughly investigated, and are not covered by a system that has its own self-preservation at its core.
What I'm going to talk about are the stories from our two reports of investigations into the rights of women in prison in Northern Ireland. The first one, The Hurt Inside, published in 2004 on McGabbery, and the second one, published just a few weeks ago, The Prison Within on High Bank Wood. There are copies here, they don't cost anything, so people want, there's some here and some outside, people want to take copies at the end. Before discussing the findings of the report, I want to briefly focus on the death of 19-year-old Annie Kelly, who died in Mournhouse in McGabbery in 2002. And Annie Kelly's death was one of the catalysts that led the Human Rights Commission to believe that we needed to carry out an investigation into what was happening in Mournhouse. Annie has said she was a 19-year-old young woman from Strabane, and in September 2002 she was found hanging in the early afternoon in a punishment cell in Mournhouse. Annie was the 10th of a family of 12 children, and she first got into trouble at the age of 13 following the death of her brother by a tragic accident. She was sent to training school in Middletown and then to Rathgale. Phil said they call these places training schools, but in effect they are child prisons, a way of locking children up. Her behaviour in Rathgale was considered too difficult to manage, and at the age of 15 Annie Kelly was sent to Mournhouse in McGabbery, a 15-year-old child in an adult high security prison. From 1997 until September 2002, Annie was committed to prison on 28 occasions. She would be released, she would relied on alcohol, she would drink heavily, and it was rarely long until she would be returned to McGabbery, just usually a few days out, and then she would be back in. Annie was diagnosed as having problems associated with personality disorder, but was said to have no mental illness. Yet she heard voices, and she self-harmed. She cut her arms, she banged her head, she inserted metal objects under her skin, she strangled herself with ligatures until she fell unconscious. When she was in McGabbery in Mournhouse, Annie was usually held in the punishment block in isolation, 23-hour lock-up, despite her young age. Her violence against prison officers was used as justifying holding her in isolation. And prison officers would only enter the cell three at a time, three members of staff dressed in riot gear to even put in food to a teenage girl. Despite this, teachers said, and other professionals, clergy, said that they found Annie polite, with a good sense of humour, and that they never once felt threatened by her. In her last letter to her sister from the jail, Annie wrote about how she had been transferred to the male hospital. An all-male control and restraint team of prison officers had arrived and told Annie that she had to undress and put an anti-suicide gown on. Annie wrote to her sister, "They all held me out in the corridor. I only had the suicide dress on. I was told I could keep my pants because I had a sanitary towel on. But when the men were holding me, they got a woman's screw to pull my pants off. That shouldn't have happened. Then they covered me in sellotape to keep the dress closed and handcuffed me and dragged me off to the male hospital." Annie stuck in a hospital cell for 6 days, but then she rested and was returned to the Mornhouse punishment block. Her letter to her sister continued by saying that the cell floor is covered in piss because they took the piss pot out last night. In her punishment cell, there's no toilet, there's no sink, simply a potty, a child's potty in the corner to use. She told her sister there were flies in the cell. Annie wrote her letter home on the 13th of August, 2002. On the 30th of August, she was visited by a member of the Board of Visitors in the punishment cell. She was refusing to eat and told the member of the Board of Visitors that she had no ambition except to die. On 5th September, Annie was found lying on the cell floor with a ligature around her neck tied to the window. The lack of female officers had made it impossible to search Annie to prevent her hiding ligatures about herself. 2 days later, on 7th of September, Annie died, found hanged in the cell in the early afternoon. 2 years later, in November 2004, Phil and myself both attended the inquest and gave evidence at the inquest into Annie Kelly's death. The inquest jury found that the long periods of isolation that she had suffered in the punishment cell had contributed to Annie's death. They considered that Annie should never have been in prison and that the law needed to be changed to provide help for women with personality disorder instead of locking them up. As I said, Annie's death really was a catalyst for the Human Rights Commission to carry out an investigation into the rights of women in Mornhouse and McGabbrey. The fieldwork for our report, The Hurt Inside, was carried out from March until May 2004. We interviewed women prisoners, prison officers, teachers, health workers, people working for voluntary organisations. And we also, because we were there for the 3 months, we were able to observe the daily regime at work. And we found that there had previously been a very critical report by the Prisons Inspectorate into Mornhouse, and the Prisons Inspectorate had made recommendations for change. In particular, they'd been really critical of the fact that the women's hospital had closed and that women were having to go to the male prison hospital. But what we found was that far from responding to the Inspectorate's concerns, the regime in Mornhouse had actually deteriorated even further. Approximately 80% of the officers were men, the night guard was often male, and this had serious implications for women's safety. As I said, those officers weren't able to search women if they suspected that they had ligatures about themselves. A nurse told us, to quote the nurse, "We got a call the other night that a female prisoner had stripped herself and was hanging. The prison officer couldn't go in until a female came across from the other side of the prison. And it would take, you know, up to 20 minutes for women officers to be able to get across from the other side of the prison." And women told us, I mean, effectively it's what Phil was saying about the continuum of violence at every level in the prison. They told us that when they went into the prison they got no support. One woman said to us, "I know myself, when I came in I was terrified. I'd never seen a jail, never mind being in one. I was just thrown onto the wing. It was one of the other girls that told me the ropes and what to expect. It was the girls who were there for me, not the staff." Another woman said to us, "There's an elderly woman in at the minute. When she came in it was about 10 at night. She was just thrown in a cell with a pint of milk and a tub of butter and told not to press the buzzer unless she was dying. That's what they said. Now that's not the way to treat anyone in prison." We find a regime where women were regularly locked in cells for 17 hours a day. Workshops were closed. Education was rarely happening. For many women, the regime consisted of being locked alone in their cells with TV for extended periods of time. And we often hear on local radio programs and in the media about what a disgrace it is that prisoners have televisions and PlayStation in the cell. Actually, that fits the prison service very well, because you can simply lock a prisoner up at 7:30 at night or earlier and leave them till the next morning and let the television do the work rather than having interaction between officers and prisoners. A woman prisoner described that she said, "Morehouse simply houses prisoners, place the prisoner in a cell with a TV and feed until release. TVs are cheaper than allocating more staff to organise constructive activities." It's a pity the media wouldn't look at it that way. We found in Morehouse a very high level of security, despite the fact that most of the prisoners could in no way be described as presenting any security risk. Many of the women were fine defaulters, hadn't paid the TV licence, been fined, and not been able to pay the fine, ended up in prison, or were suffering from mental illness. Yet despite the fact that they were low security women, the women couldn't even attend education classes or go to the gardens unless they were escorted by at least 3 prison officers. The teachers told us, for example, that classes were being cancelled because prison officers were saying that there weren't enough of them to escort the woman, and yet the teachers were saying that they would have felt perfectly safe escorting the woman themselves. The lives of women with children revolved around making a brief daily phone call to their children. A long-term prisoner told us, "My only priority in the day is contacting my children. There's nothing worse than a day goes by and you don't speak to them. There's nothing worse than going to bed that night knowing you've not spoken to them. If it's limited access to the phone, chances are you won't even get a phone. And if you do, it will only be for 2 minutes, and that's no good, especially if there's a problem at home and they want to talk to you about it. I just want to get through the day, one day at a time, one day left till I get back to my children." The care of women with mental health problems was raised by just about all of the women that we interviewed. And all of the women agreed that it was a very serious issue in the prison, and that the care of women with mental health problems is inappropriate. A remand prisoner told us, "We have serious mental health issues in here. When you say this to people, they laugh, but it's no joking matter when you're on the landing with these people." She told us, "About a week ago, one of the wee girls self-harmed the whole way up her arm by taking a blade out of a sharpener. They, prison officers, wouldn't open the door until she put out the blade. Now that wee girl could have been bleeding to death, but they still wouldn't open the door until she put the razor blade out." Women also talked about, what Phil was talking about, the goading women on to kill themselves. And at Annie Kelly's inquest, we'd heard from her sister, who'd also been in the prison, how Annie had been goaded, why don't you do it right next time, when she had tried to kill herself. When we were doing the research, women told us similar stories. One woman told us of an incident. She said, "I often sit in my cell and think, I can't believe I'm hearing this. The week before last, a senior officer and night guard, she said, this woman had twice that day tried to hang herself. One of the officers said, 'Could you leave keys? I'm not content just looking through the glass. She could have a ligature around her neck.' Other officer said, 'No, don't be looking in at her. Don't even look at her. Fuck her.' That's the way it was going, but it was top volume. Fuck the old bitch. Let her go. This was soon boom. And everyone on our landing, even the hardened ones, thought it was outrageous. There wasn't an ounce of respect shown to her as a human being." A former prisoner described to us an older woman with mental health problems who was desperate for a cigarette, being held in the strip cell in the prison. The former prisoner said to us that the woman ate with her fingers. She said they'd taunt her at the door by blowing smoke through the door. They would taunt her, they would laugh at her. She continued, "She tried to hang herself, and 3 of us saw her getting out of the ambulance. The officer," she said, "walked the woman across the tarmac in February with a suicide blanket on. They had all the riot gear on. She was crying. They were bringing her back from hospital, and she was put back in the punishment block. We just kept our heads down. Just did our time." Well, some women have serious mental health problems before being in prison, and the mental health problems have essentially led to them being in the prison. Other women were facing depression and other mental health problems as a result of the regime and as a result of being in prison. A long-term prisoner told us, "You have too much time, you sit and think about your family, you have nothing to occupy your mind. I felt real depression. They said they'd get the psychiatric nurse to come and see me, but she never came." Punishment block was an entirely inappropriate environment for the location of distressed and self-harming women and girls. Punishment cells comprised a raised plinth for a bed, no mattress, apart from an very kind of thin anti-suicide, wasn't really a mattress. No prison, no pillow, no furniture, often nothing to read, apart from the Bible. Some of the cells had a toilet and a sink, but the dry cells for the suicidal woman only had a child's potty, as I said, to use as a toilet. When we went there to visit the punishment cells at the beginning of the research, we found two women there. One was a middle-aged woman with a history of mental ill health and alcohol problems. Prison officers were using cups of tea to manage her. She'd be refused access to tea unless she behaved, and there were. And the other was a 17-year-old child, diagnosed again, personality disorder. She had a history of abuse. She'd been in and out of prison since she was 15, extensively self-harmed, heard voices at the night that told her to self-harm, and yet she was in 23-hour lockup, told that she could only get access to the grounds on it, wearing the anti-suicide gown with no appropriate footwear. We contacted her solicitor and got involved in the judicial review. Phil gave evidence at the judicial review to try and get her moved out of the punishment block, and the judge ordered that she be moved to the prison hospital, which she was. And when we visited the prison again, the punishment block again, a couple of weeks later, there she was, back in the punishment block. And despite the judge's ruling, the prison service had put her back into the punishment block again. So those were the findings of the research. I want to talk here, again, there's only time to talk about it briefly, but to talk about the death of 34-year-old Roseanne Irvine. And I just want to say to people that Roseanne's sister Josephine is here tonight, and I know that both Phil and myself would really like to pay tribute to both Josephine and to the whole Irvine family for the way that, despite their own grief about Roseanne's death and the way that they've had to deal with that, they've continued, despite that grief, to try to get answers and to try and get justice for Roseanne, and I would just still have nothing but respect for the family for the way that they've done that, you know, and we'll also play our part in drinking. So I just want to say, to talk a little bit about Roseanne's death, which happened 2 days after we started the research, and sadly, and it'll always be a regret to Phil and myself that we didn't get to meet Roseanne. The jury, we both gave evidence at the inquest, recent inquest into Roseanne's death, and the jury found that Roseanne's mental health needs have not been met in the community. The inquest heard that Roseanne sadly had a history of alcohol dependence over the recent years before she died. She had a history of depression, self-harm and suicide attempts, and we heard how that she hadn't received effective care in the community for that. And as a result of that, Roseanne has ended up in prison, largely through attempts to hurt herself rather than hurting anyone else. Roseanne's history of self-harm and suicide attempts were very well known to prison staff and managers. During our research, a professional worker told us, "Everyone realised that Roseanne had great needs. She couldn't cope here and she couldn't cope in the community." The professional told us, however, that provision fell short because no one put their hand up for overall responsibility. The Grand had arrived in the prison in a very distressed state. She'd spoken of her fears that she might lose access to her daughter, and we heard at the inquest professionals saying that that wasn't the case and that she wouldn't lose access. But Roseanne herself was very worried that this was going to happen because she worshipped her daughter, and her daughter was her one meaning really in life. At the inquest we heard that just prior, a couple of days prior to Roseanne's death, she'd been pulling out her hair and saying that she was going to kill herself because of her stress. Because of fears for Roseanne's safety, she was placed on a punishment block. Now we've already heard that the punishment block wasn't appropriate. The prison service really knew that Annie Kelly had died only 2 years previously in the punishment block, and yet Roseanne was put in the punishment block for her own safety. A woman told us in an interview during the research, Roseanne has had to lie on wood in the punishment block. Another woman said that Roseanne had said that she was sore on her back after the punishment block. She was in the punishment block for a brief period, but then the prison officers decided that she was in better form and that they would move her back to her ordinary cell in C2 landing, despite the fact that the cell had multiple ligature points, including fancy metalwork on the windows. Roseanne had been on the list to see the doctor for 3 days in succession, but on each day the sick parade was late in reaching the women's unit because the doctor was first having to go to the male side of the prison. What the routine was that the doctor would go to the male side, see prisoners there, and essentially if there was time they would then move on to the women's unit. And 3 days in a row Roseanne didn't get to see the doctor because the sick parade was either late and only had time to see the woman that were recommended by the prison officers, or else it didn't come at all. At the inquest, the coroner, Mr. Leckie, made the point in relation to this this way of practice. He said that women were treated like second-class citizens in the jail. By the time of her death, Roseanne still had not seen a doctor. The night of her death, Roseanne told another prisoner and told staff that she swallowed 5 blue tablets which had been given to her by another prisoner. No one knew for sure what the blue tablets were, and yet despite this, a nurse decided that Roseanne was well enough to be locked up for the night. During her research, a woman prisoner stated that in the evening of her death, Roseanne told me, the woman said, not long before we got locked up, that the staff did not check in women every hour, and she said to me, one of these nights they will find someone hanging and they will be dead. That very night, Roseanne was found dead. The woman, who was a friend of Roseanne, continued, if the staff had checked on Roseanne more often that night, she might be alive today. They knew she was down. The girl needed help, which she did not get. She was so down, this place was like hell on earth. A woman in her cell on C2 told us that she had been able to hear another woman squealing and shouting to Roseanne, but no buzzer went off. The woman said she was convinced the officers had turned off the emergency cell buzzers. And unfortunately the inquest was never able to get to the bottom of whether the buzzers had been turned off or not. The jury at the inquest into Roseanne's death produced a finding that was extremely critical of the prison service. The jury stated the prison system failed Roseanne. The jury found that Roseanne should not have been in prison, but should have received health care in a therapeutic setting. The inquests into the deaths of both Annie Kelly and Roseanne Irvine have provided some answers to the circumstances that led to their death. Both have led to very critical findings by the jury. I think the juries in both cases were very clearly very moved by what they heard. But despite these incredibly serious findings, you know, that the prison system failed Roseanne, despite that, no one has been held accountable for either death or for the death of Janet Holmes before. So given the seriousness of the Commission's findings in the Herb side, coupled with the findings from the jury in these inquests, the Commission continues to campaign for an independent public inquiry into conditions for women in Mournhouse from 2002 to 2004 and into these deaths. In her last letter home, Annie Kelly told her sister, "At the end of the day, I know that if anything happens to me, there will be an investigation." There hasn't been an effective investigation, and we want to make sure that such an investigation happens. And I know that Kieran and his organisation, and that those of you here present tonight, you know, anything that you can do that will assist to keep campaigning for that investigation and for justice for the women who were in Moorhouse. I want to move on now to talk in the last few minutes about the material from the new report on the prison within, about the women who are now in Hyde Bank Wood, not very far from where we're having the meeting tonight, just on the outskirts of Belfast. Women prisoners were transferred to Hyde Bank Wood in June 2004. Prior to the move, the Commission argued that Hyde Bank Wood wasn't suitable for women prisoners. We warned the prison that it was inappropriate to move women from a male high security prison to a boys young offenders centre. When the woman moved, they weren't going to have any incel sanitation. And again, we said you cannot move women in the 21st century to a prison unit that has no incel sanitation. We were also continued to be worried that the healthcare facilities would be shared with the young men, and that the woman would be transported in vans with the young men. Despite our warnings, the transfer went ahead. In 2004, there was an unannounced inspection of the unit by the prisons inspectorate, and the inspectorate backed up essentially what we had warned. They found that there were serious concerns about safety in the prison, particularly in relation, they said, to the management of vulnerable and damaged women and girls. They doubted the extent to which Ash House, the women's unit in Hyde Bank Wood, can provide a suitable environment for women, and they recommended that Ash House be declared a temporary facility and that a discreet women's facility be built, essentially vindicating what we had said. At first we weren't allowed to do, by the prison service, to go in and do the research, and we didn't have the power to insist that we did. But by late 2005 we negotiated access, and the report documents the findings of our research, which was carried out in the prison in December 2005 up until April 2006. Our findings confirmed that the shared site in Hyde Bank Wood between the boys and the women continues to contribute to a range of human rights violations. Women prisoners continue to be denied access to the prison grounds unless they're escorted by staff. A woman told us, even walking to the house, to the education or to the garden, it's not very far, but you have to be escorted at all times. It's like the women are just thrown down into this wee corner of this YOC because there's nowhere else for them. Initially the women were subject to persistent verbal abuse from young male prisoners, and occasionally the young woman retaliated to the boys. A woman prisoner described how after a very emotional carol service, she said, "The abuse from the boys has been appalling, and no one attempted to stop them. They shouted, 'Show us your tits.' It was emotional coming out of the service. We didn't need that." By the time of our research, that sort of verbal abuse from the boys had been much reduced, but the cost of achieving that had been through the operation of a highly restrictive regime. We were told that part of the reason for moving the woman from Moorhouse to Hyde Bank Wood was that it's a low security prison, it would be much more relaxed, the atmosphere will be much more free than the woman have had in McGavery. What's happened was that to run the show with the woman on this site with the boys, they've had to really operate a very restrictive and high security regime. Boys and women aren't even allowed to acknowledge each other on passing on the site, and women with sons or partners in the male YOC found it distressing. One woman told us, "My son is over in the YOC and I spoke to him in the education block. You're not supposed to speak to them, but what could I do? It's very strict here." Women and men regularly share transport to and from the court. Women were subjected to verbal abuse on the van. One woman said she dreaded the bus journey as much as she dreaded the court. All of the women commented on the degradation of strip searches on reception. And women were women are basically strip searched every time they go to court, every time they come back from court, and there are random searches when women are going to their visits, you know, their family visits. For example, the strip searches are conducted by female officers, but the woman says that that didn't stop it being such a degrading process which led them feeling so demeaned. Just a couple of quotes from women to illustrate that. The woman said, "I was told to strip naked and pass out each item of clothing to the officer for inspection. Then I was told to turn around so the officer could make note of any piercings or tattoos. I was totally humiliated. I never in all my life experienced anything so invading. I was distraught and quite fearful." Another woman said, "When you're on your menstrual cycle, you still have to strip. It's very degrading. You have to show them your pants and pads with the blood on it. It's disgusting. You're embarrassed. Their attitude is indifferent. It's their job. But it's not a nice thing to do." And I think that's one of the legacies of really of the conflict, the way that strip searching, despite again the fact that this is a low security prison, that you've still got this degree of strip searching going on, and it's a legacy back from our now. "We've been promised there would be a busy regime for women, but that has never materialised. Gardening continues to be one of the only forms of work for women. Most disturbing was the regime for the vulnerable or at-risk prisoners, the self-harming and suicide women. They mostly sit, when they are, on the short hours when they're unlocked, they mostly sit in silence at the table smoking, occasionally watching TV. For those women most in need of therapeutic regime, there's nothing to do. The mental health care continues to be deficient. So although self-harming and suicidal women are no longer consigned to 23-hour lock-up in the punishment block, and they hold frequent prisoner at risk paid conferences, the regime itself is dominated by security and discipline and offers no therapeutic potential." And I want to finish with the case of a woman who we found, we observed her care, and she was held on the landing for vulnerable prisoners. And I just want to give her a case to illustrate how in some ways things have changed, but how, as Phil said, the very nature of imprisonment can continue to lead to a case where women really are at risk of dying in this regime. Staff had noticed that this woman was more depressed after the Christmas period when we were doing her research. They said that she had told them herself that she thought that she was going to kill herself. She said that she was finding the noise on the landing difficult to cope with, and she said that she wanted to be transferred to the healthcare centre for a couple of nights to get some peace. The healthcare centre, remember, is shared between the boys and the woman. We observed the meeting that was there between all the professionals to decide what would happen about the woman's request to be put into the hospital. The problem, the staff said, was that the healthcare centre was shared between boys and women. They said, although the boys and women didn't associate, the boys could call out abuse to women at night. Neither the boys nor the women could be let out of their cell at the same time. A nurse warned that there was one young man in the healthcare centre who was a danger to women and who was likely to shout out abuse. Furthermore, the cognitive behaviour therapy nurses who were dealing with the woman had recommended a busy regime, but in hospital she would have to be locked up for most of the day as well as the night. She would have to wear an anti-suicide gown, which she hated because it didn't fit her, and she would have to have her jewellery, which she loved, taken out of her. The professionals discussed this and then brought the woman into the meeting, and she came in and she was shaking and she was distressed, and she said she was told of all these worries about putting her into the hospital. But she said that she still felt that she was really at risk of taking her own life and that she wanted to be moved for a couple of days. So she was moved. We visited her in the healthcare centre the next morning because we were really worried about her safety. We found her unlocked and mopping the floor in the anti-suicide gown. And she said that she wanted back onto the ordinary landing, and we wanted to know why. And she said that in the hospital, her cigarette lighter had been taken off her the night before, but she'd been promised that if she knocked the door, that a member of staff would light the cigarette for her. During the night, she said that she'd banged the door until her hands hurt, and the staff had refused to light her cigarette. She hadn't been able to sleep, and the boy, the young boy, although he hadn't shouted any abuse, he played music until late at night, so she didn't get the quietness she hoped for. What you could see from the woman's care was that although all of the attention was being given to bring all the professionals around to discuss her care, the very regime itself was unable to offer her anything and was unable to offer a therapeutic environment. So the Human Rights Commission were campaigning for a new woman's prison based on more therapeutic lines, but were also campaigning for prisons to be used as little as possible for both men and for women, but particularly for women, and for an end to imprisonment, both for fine defaulters, for non-serious offences, for women with babies and small children, and for women with mental health problems, because prison cannot provide the answers for these women, and it continues through its regime to put them at much greater risk of ending their own lives.
Thanks very much, Brendan. Well, that was brilliant. I just want to thank you for just saying you have to understand that the cause, it's very important to remember, the cause of prison neglect, the cause of the macho, the cycle of violence that Phil spoke about, the cause of the neglect itself, it's nothing to do, the jail and the state will tell us it's to do with staff shortages, they'll tell us it's to do with funding, it's nothing to do with that. It's down to the culture of regime. Jail is running junkets. The jail has money. When jail needs money, it gets money. It's nothing to do. When jail doesn't need staff, parts of the support will also tell you that people were denied education for weeks on end because teachers weren't trusted to take one prisoner from a cell to a classroom. And that is down to a culture of the regime. The regime culture in prison, it's very often, it's, when I say it's right wing, it's a completely unaccountable regime. Quite often it's run by Christians, so-called Christians, who have this notion of these people are scum, they deserve nothing. They see punishment as part of the sentence as well. They emphasise punishment and. They're able to push through this line. And if I could just give one example, something very worrying that happened in April. Paul Gardner's the security minister, and I have to remember these ministers we have no control over what happens in the jails. Paul Gardner's announced in April that 2/3 remission was going to be ended, it's going to be phased out, so prisoners were just going to have to serve all their time. This was going to mean a 2/3 increase of prison population within in a period of 5 years. On the same day, what wasn't publicly announced, but it was decided on the same day, was the introduction of CS spray, or what they're calling incapacitating spray. Now, you look at the rationale why this was released on the same day. All I can see is Paul Gardner's announcing to the POA, an extreme right-wing BUP union, you could call it, this is what it is, coming to terms with the fact that they were going to have an increase of 2/3 in population. No doubt the POA said to Paul Gardner, said to the British government, how are we to deal with this? And he said, gaff. There's no other explanation. Now that's just one, there's a million things we can talk about prisons, but they can, that is the culture, and that is the cause. It's nothing to do with staff shortages. So again, I want to come back to this two prongs process. This is how they do it. They rely on the public being ignorant, and they rely on the public falling for their dehumanising line. They have a dehumanising process. We see it through scumbag journalists like Stephen Nolan, Jim McDowell, push this line out. These people are scum, they're less. What we can do is we can refuse to buy into that argument. We remember that all prisoners are humans with the same feelings like us. If you take any prisoner, go into their history, you'll find a social reason for why they're there. It's not genetic, it's not. They're not. There's no such thing as a bad person, and that's very hard. I mean, some of these communities are being tortured on a nightly basis. We know this, but the answer is not. The prison propagates that. Prison repeats that. Prison takes them values, anti-social values, nurtures them, nurtures violence, and throws it back into our communities again. It doesn't help things. So One we can do, we can refuse the ban of the dehumanization arguments. We, the ABC, we, what we want people to do, and we don't claim that we can do it for other people, what we want to see is people organizing, obviously, to demand the truth, which is what Phil and Linda have done here, on better conditions, and we will do everything we can to do that. Two initiatives, I mean, the ABC is a very small organisation, they can't do everything, they can do very little actually, but two initiatives that we will be launching, and we'll ask anybody to help us. We have other people who are dehumanised in the prison process. It's not just the prisoners, it's their families, and we'll see out in visits, children are dehumanised, children are criminalised, children are treated like scum, no better way of saying it, on visits. We intend to combat that dehumanising process. We're holding a Christmas appeal, and when the visits are coming out in McGabbery and McGilligan, we want to be up there with presents, giving them out to the kids, because we want to be putting the lead back to screws who want society to lock down in prisoners' children and want to bring the problems down onto them. We also want a means to, because human rights abuses occur in jails every hour, all the time, and we don't know about it, nobody knows about it, and it's only when it comes to the point of it's followed through to the death that maybe society will come up and take notice. And the ironic thing is, it's scumbags like Stephen Nolan who give so much confidence to the prison system, and we have these shows, and I remember clearly at the time, around about the time Roseanne took her own life, there was a show on the Stephen Nolan show was on, saying these people are getting everything, what are we doing, they're up there, they're living in luxury and all, a million lives, and that was the precise type of, that gives the confidence for the screws to go out and torture people like Roseanne and get away with it. Ironically, it was Stephen Nolan's show crying when Roseanne's inquiries come in, what's going on in jails. Please, anybody who wants to help the ABC, you don't have to be an anarchist, you don't have to be a political at all. We need transport's going to be a problem. Another thing, so what we want to do is, we want to get lines of communications open so prisoners can voice on a daily basis what's happening in there, because when the jail knows somebody's looking at them, the jail pulls its arms in. And that's a fact. Thirdly, obviously, we're a revolutionary group. We say the only way that we will deal with these problems eventually is to organise for a better society, a better loving society with more humane values, society evolves, we won't things like prisons will be a thing of the past, you know. But anybody who wants to help the organisation, get in touch with me, get in touch with the boys, I'd say thanks very much, thanks for the two folks.
If people want to ask questions,
if there's anybody who wants to ask questions, now's the time, go ahead. Sorry,
I can't stay then.
Individuals who are also maybe, but they're not educated, they're not qualified to do the work. that that's supposed to be doing. That because prison was seen as something to do with their like violence and security. They're like, they should be more aligned to the mental health care. That should be the kind of person that you're attracting towards there. That should be the description, the job description, the fact that you write when you're looking for people to work in prison. I'm just wondering, like, that's what I would love to see work being done. You know, it's sort of, you know, trying to educate the public as to what prisons should be, what prisons could be, as they exist at the moment.
Who did you speak to? Sorry, I'm not the job.
Pardon?
Who were you speaking to? You said you had access to...
Austin Tracy, Deputy Governor, has left to become the Governor of the Prison. Inspirational man.
He knocked me back with parole. Really inspirational.
I have real difficulties with this because I've met many prison officers and a few managers over 30 years that I've considered to be doing a good job, whose heart's in the right place, who are really committed. There's been no recruitment to the prison service here since the early 1990s. So the prison staff we have at the moment is overwhelmingly Protestant. It's trained during the conflict. It's had almost no training since. It's overstaffed compared to any other jurisdiction in Europe because the Prison Officers Association has constantly refused to allow there to be cuts in staff. I think my position, personal position, would be I can count probably on two hands the amount of prison officers that I've interviewed here that I consider have not been dehumanised. And I would also say that those prison officers suffer at the hands of the majority.
Well,
first of all, you can't. You can't do it in the prison system. There has to be some responsibility taken by individual prison officers. There has to be some responsibility taken by their union. And there has to be some responsibility taken by their managers. I know the governance you're talking about, and I wouldn't want to get into an argument about personalities. I have yet to find a manager that I would ever even go near the word inspirational. They're not trained, nor are they equipped, as you quite rightly say, to do the job, either the staff or the managers. The healthcare staff are an anachronism. They're not healthcare staff. They walk around with white coats. They have not had proper training. One of the things we point out in the current report. The organisations that go into prison become incorporated, independent organisations, and again we've interviewed the staff, in fact I know personally many of the staff, have to think about their contracts. They have to think about their contracts in terms of continuing to work in the prison, and if they put a foot out of line they'll lose those contracts. I wouldn't say, I would be the last person to say there are not good people amongst the prison staff, but they're a minority. And one of the concerns that I have, and I tell you it's a real serious concern, the amount of people who are now going into prison, who are given what Craig Minogue, who's a life sentence prisoner in Australia, calls the zoo tour. They're given an opportunity to see a place, to interview certain selected prisoners, to be sold on an idea that things are changing and that things are good.
I was sat in the place for custody meetings. I'm an educator, but I've come from prison officers. The children, you know, every Saturday and Sunday, the prison officers give up their lunch break to.
But they're not giving up their lunch break.
They're not paid for it. They're not normally.
You have to.
Find out what the time is. They're trying, they're starving.
You can't do it. No, I would not demonize them.
I use
the language of the prison, of the prisoner. I use the language of the prisoner when I'm talking, and I always say it screws off prison officers, because I use both languages. I have to, because the issue isn't semantic. The issue is that when I interview, it's in the report again, when we interview a woman and she says, I get up in the morning, I look through the crack in my door, and I look to see who's sitting behind the table, and I know if I'm going to have an all right day or a bad day. But she never says she's going to have a good day. It's not about people. It's actually about what the institutions are prepared to tolerate. I can take you to prison officers that are truly inspirational in Hyde Park Wood. One in particular who was truly inspirational and who's treated like an outcast by many of the other officers. But to say, how do you then encourage that? You can't. You know, you can't encourage that, because what you have is an institutionalized setting that systematically and systemically fails in prisons that are not fit for purpose, are outdated, are falling apart. McGilligan, if we can even begin to tolerate McGavery and McGilligan as two institutions, then we've lost the debate, because both of them should fall down. And I'm not arguing for more prisons, I'm arguing for appropriate custody and fully trained staff. And the small handful of prisoners who are struggling with that, prison officers who are struggling with that, are not in the majority. But I'm afraid that when we have tours of prison, when we have journalists going into prison, when we have films being made, when we have articles being written, you know, every single time, and as I say, I can go back over 30 years, I despair.
I worked in Manchester prison. The prisons inside are worse than they are here. I am under no illusion as to prisons are going to be worse than here. They're horrific places. I'm not disagreeing with you at all. I just think they're not going anywhere. So there has to be some kind of debate that includes everybody and doesn't point the finger at and therefore dehumanize and
enemize. I think you need to be very careful about believing a regime that lies as policy, right? This is a regime that also operates a policy of barely accepting an ombudsman, and its officers operate a policy of ignoring the ombudsman. At least that's the way it was last. At this time last year, I remember officers clearly saying, "Right, complain away. We're not cooperating with them." Why is that the case? There's no, you know, this is a, you have to understand. You've a section of society that is voiceless, that probably has gone without education. You know, most cases that can't stand up for themselves, that has no confidence. Up against an agency of the state, a power of the state who has public relations experts behind it, all forms of the media is out of its hands, you know. So of course you're going to come in. I'm not trying to cast doubt on your genuinity, but you know, of course you're going to go into an institution like that and you're going to find somebody, a man like Austin Tracy, inspirational, you know. I would like to take you to tour of the jail myself, you know, but we can't
just I agree with kind of fellow's analysis in terms of, you know, the small number of very good officers, and a governor, a senior governor said to us during the research, their estimation was 20% good officers. And things are bad if a governor is thinking they're 20% good officers, then things really are bad. But what we've tried to show, I think, is that it's not about good and bad as individuals. Now, some of the individuals, what they did was absolutely disgusting in McGavery, and there's no other way, and Hyde Park Wood, and there's no other way around that, and they should be punished for that, for the way that they treat the woman and children. But it's about the process itself as well, and what a woman told us, for example, was that the reception staff who stripped them now are more civil, by and large, than the staff were in McGavery. It didn't make what they experienced any less degrading or any less demeaning to them, and it's about that process of people arriving in, being stripped, being locked in a cell for nearly all of the day, you know, having to be escorted around the place, being put in a van with the boys. The whole process itself is degrading, and the officers are pulled into that. Even the good ones are involved in, you know, locking the woman up over lunchtime, locking them up at night, 23-hour lockups if there aren't enough staff on. It would take a very, very brave officer to actually challenge what's going on. And we saw a small number of good officers doing good work. We didn't see people actually challenging and taking on the system. When we found a 17-year-old girl in a punishment cell, cell park, cut to bits, with a potty in the corner, smell in the cell, it's awful. Not one officer challenged that. People would say to you, it's wrong, you know, in a private interview. Not one person stood up and said, this is just a disgrace that this is happening and I'm having no part in it. Not one.
And the governor you mentioned actually conducted an inquiry into that, into that prison at that time. We're only talking about 3 years ago, and none of the recommendations that came out in any way touched on the things that we've exposed. I mean, that's one of the great problems we face, you know, is that you cannot just take a few examples of people who are working in a positive way as indicative of the institutionalized degradation of the system. And that's the crucial problem. And, you know, for the record as well, I don't think prison officers can ever be social workers in a prison, because the whole dichotomy of custody and care is such. When I see prison officers getting butler awards for the work that they do that is positive, I would say that is them doing their job, and yet it's somehow seen as exceptional. And so, you know, from my point of view, it's not that I have a down on prison officers. Prison officers are basically paid. They're called discipline officers. That's what they're called. And they cannot ever be in a situation where you can fully trust their judgment. And when woman after woman after woman, in the research on the male prisons here and the research I've done on male prisons in England, every single prisoner that you speak to says, I cannot ever trust a prison officer. That's not because they're all horrible people. It's because at the end of the day, the prison officer's primary responsibility on the disclosure of any information whatsoever is one of discipline and custody. It has nothing to do with care and good health. And that's the dichotomy. It can't work. You know, and that's why the whole concept of prison has to be challenged. And I agree that there will be always certain programs that are offered and so on. But, you know, how on earth can we have a situation where prison officers are running anger management programs, you know, they're running a whole range of other facilities within prison, when they, comparing to skills, whatever, how can they do that effectively with the trust of those families and the trust of those prisoners, when prisoners know that if there's any slight disclosure of any information that could be useful or compromises the individual, they will not hesitate but to report them. And that's a massive problem. That is an institutionalized problem within prison.
I could relate to it. The first time I arrived in prison was in 1970. And the whole prison was based on Sunday attacking Seychelles. My very well was who my own Seychelles from. You're brought in, and you're pushing with Seychelles, you're filled out. And the man that's sitting down in front of you, more than the governor of the prisoners at the prison at that time, were all actually army people, majors and so on like that. And that, the whole system was based on the authority telling you what to do. What time you get up in the morning, trying to dehumanize you from the, you get up in the morning, tell you what to get at night. And only a number. And I could relate that. Another thing that I think was very important, I don't think it's about that the fact that people, way prisoners relate to one another, and the problems they have, and there's an awful lot of violence, and I'm not talking about video violence, come with the tool out of the big army and the army but people and people tend to come to the thing, but they don't know what people don't know what problems prisoners have. You know, I mean, they may go in the visit and they'll be pretty great down the visit and back in the next day they're down in the. You see, we've got a profession, right? But most of them have got a bad news. And not all reflects on the way people react when they're in prison. And you also have the other point that you mentioned about the effect on people's families. And, you know, it's not only when you send somebody to prison, you're condemning you're sending their family too, and their children. You know, and I think that I would support, I don't know if it would go as far as caring. But maybe I haven't thought about it as much as caring. But I think that there's a major reform needed at the moment within the prison system. But I think another point is that the housing system, which cost effectiveness and the privatization of prison, you know, with all this privatization agenda that's on the way here, the privatization of prison, and it's cheaply, you're going to be able to live off the prisoner. And there is a need for society, and I think society should be judged on how to face the left way of their life. And there's nobody left that has been prisoner.
There's no prisoner
to
bother.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, from your description, it sounds enlightenment. I have a question in two parts. First of all, is it such a thing as a prison charter here? And secondly, if there were a prison charter which hopefully would guarantee some sort of minimum of, like, for example, the right access to education, to some sort of meaningful occupation, and the right to self treatment, you know. Anyway, if the prison charter did exist,
Well, obviously, I mean, one of the things we've looked at in the reports are that prisoners are entitled under international human rights law and principles to a whole range of standards, very many of which are breached in prisons in Northern Ireland, you know, but anything. Obviously anything that highlights prisoners' rights, both to prisoners themselves and to their families and to those involved in the system would be really, you know, good, and really good to have any kind of a charter. But I mean, I think what we've tried to show is how the whole process of imprisonment itself, you know, will continue to breach rights, you know, regardless of charters. But yeah, I mean, it would be, you know, the more that the rights can be publicised and can be put down there and can be something that we can measure the prisons against, then yeah, that's
one of the problems with the way it operates at the moment in almost all imprisoning jurisdictions, and there are very good examples of places that don't imprison or imprison in lesser numbers and only as a last resort and are human rights compliant, where the disciplinary processes do not take precedence over care. But here, and certainly in the UK, which are two of the, I think in terms of advanced democratic states, there's no question that they are right now at the top of the abusive regimes. Not to say there aren't some prisons within that system that operate better regimes, but overall, Britain and the North here, and I will accept in Ireland too, not just Mountjoy but Portlaoise. You know, they operate the aisles, if you like, they operate amongst the worst standards. And one of the things that is always used is the prisoner's compact, which is that if you sign up for certain courses and you sign up to do certain things, you will then be granted privileges. And when we look at those privileges, what we find that is being traded as a kind of currency is rights. You know, in other words, you have an extra quarter of an hour on your visit. What use is a half hour visit to a family in a public situation? You have an extra quarter of an hour if you sign up for this compact. Or if you if you we'll allow you out of your cell for an extra half hour. What use is that to anybody when we're already dealing with such appalling isolation? I was reading in Amnesty only last night, after Sonny Jacobs' brilliant lecture here on the death penalty. I was reading in the current Amnesty International about the lockdown times and how we should write to various states because prisoners were being held in virtual solitary confinement for very long hours. And I just thought, write to your own government. Write to your own government as well while you're at it. If you don't work in McGavery, for example, and you're not on work detail, and the last inspection report demonstrates this clearly in McGavery, you don't get out yourself. Now, it's not the prisoners' fault that there is no work for them. So they spend these long hours locked up in solitary confinement in a prison that is completely inappropriate for their needs, that in both in terms of its establishment and its regime. So whoever is trying to provide any facility in that, it falls well below international human rights standards. It is completely incredible to me that we've had report after report going back now over 30 years about the dehumanization of prisons. And I accept, like anyone would in terms of alienation, that it dehumanizes all who come into contact with it, including academic researchers. You know, and I think that in that situation, what we've had report after report, and still we're having exactly the same debate, and still we're having the same little bits of isolated good practice being put up for Butler Awards, when they're only just, that all they're doing is giving the prisoner their basic rights. I mean, we haven't even touched on stuff that is so appalling, like the contract that the prisons have with BT, which means that people can't phone other than at it costs a prisoner four times as much to phone within this jurisdiction as it costs me to phone at maximum time on my BT standard contract. And they're tied into that contract. So when you've got, you know, women out of cell time, maybe 2 hours, 3 hours, fathers out of cell time, maybe 2 hours, 3 hours, desperate to ring their families, there's a queue behind them, and they're on the phone, and they're trying to share some sort of important information, and their time's up. You know, they've got 3 or 4 minutes, and it's costing them a fortune. £30, £40 a week, just to try and keep in contact with the families. Yet one of the basic principles of every international convention is to retain and build strong family contact, you know, and so you get into this problem of always trading. I mean, I agree with what you're saying in terms of there should be a basic form of charter. But in one sense, we have it built in already to international human rights standards, and we systematically abuse them.
I was just going to clarify here from behalf of for those of us, we know our premise is to work with families and for that prison, I'm trying to wait for you to those things about this court. Send the prison state, the capital. Okay, there is a point made out correctly that should go into a so I'd like to ask another question. How has prisoners improved their conditions? Has it been over the last maybe 30 years? Because there's open listening to Athens prisoners and federal prisoners over the last 30 years. The real change came about through prisoners taking direct action, citizen protests, and improving their conditions through that route, rather than the legal route, like lobbying the government, writing letters, etc. And I can see now that all of them, like all in the force, but what you're needed are being steadily eroded. Similar prisons, similar that other things happen, like they're eroded from the welfare community, etc. Just like you ask someone yourself, the method, the most empowering method, has really been through the prisoners taking control and taking back the limits of themselves.
I would say something about the woman prisoners, and then you can talk about that or more generally. What we found with women prisoners was that there were some really brave individual women prisoners who were prepared to take the fight forward, and certainly pay tribute one woman, you know, whose name's in the public domain, Karen Carson, and she's a woman the Human Rights Commission supported her in taking a legal case around strip searching and the lack of toilets in High Banquhood, and the judge agreed with her that at that point the women were being strip searched every single visit. So if we visited, if their probation officer visited, if a social worker or a solicitor visited, the family visited, they were strip searched every single time. And Karen took the case to court and she won her judicial review that that was a breach of her human rights. And as a result, the women are strip searched random 1 in 10 visits now, you know, which isn't great, but it shows at least that she was able to bring them out when she was saying that this would end for the women. The other thing, what was done to the women in Morehouse and High Bank Road was that the situation is quite different for, I think, for mothers particularly, than it may be for other prisoners, in that women were very fearful about taking on the system because they were terrified that, you know, it's just bartering that Phil talked about. If you're assertive and you challenge what's going on, you lose one of your visits. And you need your visits because you're so desperate to maintain contact with your children. And how are you going to explain to small children that you've lost a visit? So many of the women have mental health problems that they just weren't in a state to take on the system. And so while elsewhere there are really brilliant examples of prisoners taking on and fighting back against the system, very many of the women that we talked to just weren't in a situation where they were able to do that, you know, and that's why it's so important that those of us on the outside that can campaign for them do that.
I think one of the things, just to very briefly add to that, one of the things that happened here was that once the political prisoners, and I know there are still political prisoners, but once the political prisoners en masse were released, one of the safety valves of the prisons went. Because, and many of the ex-prisoners will tell you this, and many of the ordinary prisoners will tell you this, that they were a group that was organised and they were solid and that they were able to protect not only themselves and their own interests, but also the interests of ordinary prisoners. And that happened particularly with women's imprisonment. Very briefly as well, I mean, I was very, very much involved in in-depth research into prison protests in Scotland and in England, and in fact co-wrote the book Prisons Under Protest. And one of the things that became very clear to me, and I'm not in any way advocating violent rebellion, but one of the things that became very clear to me in both the English situation and also in the Scottish situation, also in Attica in 1972 in New York State, is that it was only when the prisoners rebelled, and it was at the loss of 36 lives in Attica, it's only when the prison service the prisoners rebelled that people started to take the issues really seriously. And there's no question about that. And I sat with the Director General of the Scottish Prison Service in his room with Catherine Chadwick next to me, and he said to me, "We will deny everything that you have said in public, but we agree with every word in private. And we have to get our house into order. And he made it absolutely clear to me that they embarked on a process of more humanisation. But it didn't bring the prisons up to any great standard. What it did was it tackled the worst excesses that were happening within that system. And the other thing that just struck me when I was talking earlier that I just need to be clear about, I said I was an abolitionist and I mean it. I do not think that the majority of people who are in prison in our jurisdictions need to be in prison. They should be in other situations. They should primarily be in the community. I have not met a woman in prison in the north of Ireland who should be in prison. Not one. I find the use of prison here and the use of prison in England to be, and Wales and Scotland and in Ireland, to be an outrage. We've doubled the prison population in 10 years. Doubled it. We're sending children as young as 10 to prison. When I address European audiences, they're gobsmacked by what I tell them. And I think that to me is indicative again about how we conceptualise prison. I would do away with the word prison. I'd abolish the word if I could. Let alone the actual place. Does that mean, and somebody is bound to ask, does that mean that there are people who should be, that all people should be outside of a secure facility? The answer to that is obviously not. But that doesn't mean to say that, you know, a prison abolitionist is not somebody who says, pull down all the prisons, let all the prisoners out. What a prison abolitionist is saying is there should be a continuum of provision for people who are in conflict with the law, for people who have mental health problems, for people who can't live in the community. But there should be a continuum of different provisions. And the very last resort is holding somebody in secure accommodation. That's what an abolitionist is. An abolitionist is, you know, we don't spend our lives working on these issues to have it as a simple either or. I recognise the problems that exist within our society that are not often of the making of the people who come into conflict with the law or come into conflict in terms of healthcare. But what actually we have to think about is a whole series of creative alternatives, all fit for purpose, all with properly trained staff. And you know, we have the resources to do it, because it costs an absolute phenomenal amount of money to hold people in prison. £1,500 a week to hold one person. Think what we could do with mental health services with that kind of level of input. We had £1,500 per patient. It's unbelievable, you know, we couldn't even conceptualise that provision, yet we do it when we dustbin and warehouse people. So, you know, I think that it's really important to be clear about what we would see, speak for us rather than for Kieran, what we would see as an abolitionist perspective is absolutely having a full range of facilities available to deal with all of us, I include me, who when we need support and help and care, which could lead to us coming into conflict with the law, could lead to us being in prison, that we have that appropriate help and care. When you've got children aged 14 waiting on a 2-year mental health referral list, what's going to happen to them in the next 2 years? Will they take their own life? Will they cut off? Or will they go out and smash somebody else's house up? You know, what's going to happen to them in that 2-year wait? I'll tell you what happens in the extreme example, is what happened to Roseanne. They go down that slide and eventually they take their own lives. And if they don't, their life is taken in another way. It's taken from them because they just about get by on, as she was, the 7 different forms of drugs that she was taking when she died. And so, you know, we have those alternatives, we have the creative, and all else is tinkering. All else is rearranging the furniture, you know, and people will do some good work here and some good work there. But I would be critical of one other group of people that I think I might have left out, academics. You know, I've worked all my life as an academic, and I have watched, I mean, how is it that we go into these prisons and suddenly discover all this now, when prisoners have been saying it for years anyway? But the NIO has spent literally millions of pounds on academics going in and doing research in prisons. How did they not notice what we saw with our eyes? We didn't have, you know, we haven't got some third sight, you know. How come they, and it's about how people get drawn in to the prison, how they get drawn into the establishment, and how they become incorporated, and they become institutionalised within the process. And so they are looking at the furniture moving, rather than looking at the big picture. We can't resolve these problems with the estate we have, with the staff we have, with the management we have. We have to think much differently about what we do with people who are in conflict with the law, who are a danger to themselves, a danger to others, and who are the big group, who have a whole range of different mental health needs.
Because I saw this one here, the question to ask earlier on.
We didn't ask a question and a word you used it. I'm not thinking that. What's the suicide blanket? Suicide program?
It's like, it's supposed to be indestructible, so it's essentially like a hospital gown, if you've seen those, only backwards. So instead of kind of being fastened up the Punch them on the back. And the idea is that you can't rip it up. It's not to be made of strong enough material that you can't rip it up, turn it into a noose or a ligature for yourself. But it's very degrading for people. It's bad enough in hospitals wearing such a thing, but to be going around and that's all day, and with male officers around, the woman finds it very degrading, and often they weren't allowed any underwear either, with it, although it opens up the front, so people The commission hasn't planned yet plans to look at suicide and self harm in the prison, so very much hope that will happen, because obviously we've discussed in the support some of the developments for women and mental health, but you know, it's such a huge problem for the men, and we're still seeing men dying in punishment cells in McGilligan and McGabbery, and you know, problems for the boys with mental health problems in High Bankwood, so that really urgently needs to happen. Yeah.
Can I just add one very brief thing, as I always do, one very brief thing to that, and that is the whole question of what we define as a personality disorder. One of the phrases that is now tripping off the tongue all the time, which is borderline personality disorder. Now, that's like saying you've got a borderline broken leg. You know, what are we talking about here? So personality disorder is already a heavily debated area of work within psychiatry. And the anti-psychiatrists would argue, within psychiatry, I mean the anti-psychiatrists, trying to do themselves out of the job, they would be incredibly critical of the way in which personality disorder as a DSM-6, the diagnosable mental illness, is defined. And we saw that in the court cases that we were involved with. I gave evidence for 2 hours in the Roseanne Irvine case and was questioned a lot around this very issue. It's a movable feast. But when we actually say borderline personality disorder, I know that I'm in it. I know I'm there. I've got at least 7 of the diagnosable characteristics, most of which you've seen on display tonight. And I think that you know, that idea of how these categories are used as a science that is trustworthy in order to do things to people, that is a real concern. And it doesn't only happen, as I tried to say, it doesn't only happen in prisons, it also happens in mental institutions also. To also be one thing.
I think we need to round it up. I think Colin has got full. Please come and take cabbage and it's bigger enough to... Yeah.